Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, we have a theme, one of several themes that we have in Old Variety, called Old Florida Day. And this is definitely going to be Old Florida Day. We're going to be talking, I guess I'm tentatively tongue-in-cheek calling the show Old Florida Food for Thought, because we're talking with a Miami native, an artist named Julie Lara Khan, who has done a big multimedia project about the Florida crackers. And those are the original kind of Florida natives, not the American Indian Native Americans, but the ones who winded their way down from, I guess, Georgia and Alabama into Florida in the early to mid-1800s. And so they had a whole culture unto themselves, and Julie has explored that in many different ways, as I say. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
Julie is one of these people who, like many of our guests on American Variety, is a person herself who exemplifies American Variety, a person of very diverse interests a person who has big dreams and follows them and succeeds in them. And most of the guests we have on this show, amazingly enough, are people who kind of fit that description. She's a person with a Harvard MBA and an undergraduate degree, I guess, in Asian studies. Is that right?
Yep, East Asian studies.
Right, so far. And then was a disc jockey and an English teacher in Japan, later an investment banker at Morgan Stanley, and was also involved in A&R, which I guess is scouting for talent at Columbia Records. And then has been doing, pursuing very eclectic, interesting art projects, a lot of it in Florida over the last several years. And with all of that, she's still only 21 years old. Amazing. But so, recently moved to California, but still a Florida artist as far as I'm concerned. So, Julie, let's talk about your work in general to start with. What do you do? And then we'll get to the swamp cabbage project on the crackers. But what do you do in general?
Well, my work sort of draws upon the eclectic background that you talked about. I like to include a lot of different kinds of media in my work, and it's probably what would be referred to in the art world as multidisciplinary art. And it also has sort of a conceptual base, meaning that usually it starts from an idea that I have rather than, you know, coming in and starting from an aesthetic point of view. And when an idea kind of takes hold of me, I'll sort of sit with it and grapple with it, and if it's something that I can't get out of my head, then I know it's something that I have to pursue as an art project. And it can take the shape of, you know, sort of many different forms. I'm trained in photography and filmmaking, and often those will be my first window in, but as the project moves along, I like to layer in other elements. It could be food, it could be sound, it could be everyday objects. My ultimate goal, I think, is to encourage people who come to see the show to take risks themselves, creative risks, and somehow enter into the artwork through a participation or an interaction. And I'd like to get people in the same room together who may not otherwise have met, or to encourage dialogue among really, really different kinds of people.
So you described it, Julie, as, I think, multidimensional and maybe multimedia art. If you had to put it, and I'm no art historian by any means, but if you had to kind of give it a genre, it sounds to me like what, back in the 70s, you know, when I was only 8 years old, that was called conceptual art or concept art or conceptual art. Is it something like that, or would you call it that?
Yeah, I think it would definitely be a type of conceptual art, something that starts from an idea or a concept.
And then involves not just a painting on a wall or a sculpture on a table, but a whole lot of different elements to it.
Exactly.
So why don't you describe then your Swamp Cabbage exhibition that you did recently?
Okay, Swamp Cabbage was sort of the culmination of many years of work. I started in probably 1999, and I went to visit a friend in DeLand, Florida, and her father was putting on a wild game feast. Her father was a Rotarian named Al Downs, and he was putting on a wild game feast with the DeLand Breakfast Rotary. And I just said, can I tag along and take black and white photographs? And he said, sure. And it sort of got me very interested in the cracker culture, in where the food was coming from that stocked the wild game feast. They were serving rattlesnake and gator and wild boar and all kinds of things. And started to become more and more interested in tracing the food chain back to the people who were hunting and gathering the food and harvesting the swamp cabbage. So I started, you know, with maybe 4 trips a year to Cracker Country. I was living in Miami at the time, and as time and finances would allow, I'd take trips just to kind of keep the project moving along. finally, it got to a point where I really wanted to plunge fully into it. And in 2003, I got a grant from the Florida Humanities Council, which really allowed me to move to Merritt Island and live on a derelict orange grove along the Indian River to really set up kind of a home base in Central Florida. And from there, I went out to many, many small towns like Christmas and Bithlo and Felda and LaBelle and Felsmere and DeLand and Scottsmore and Mims. I mean, towns you're probably familiar with, and start photographing and filming and taking sound samples and really exploring the project in a multidimensional, meaningful way.
So coming from Miami, Julie, was this in your native Miami? And as I mentioned, that's a whole different world. And even here in Melbourne and in this area of Central Florida on the coast, a lot of people don't realize that there's this sort of indigenous, sort of white culture in there, that it's not redneck as we think of that, but it's people who have lived for generations on the land. How would you characterize that culture, which must be disappearing and must have been a surprise to you to encounter a few years back coming from Miami?
Definitely. In Miami, I don't think I had any real sense of the culture other than when I was a child, my dad had some land in Felsmere, and we used to drive to visit the property, and also we'd take the sort of requisite family trips to Disney. So on those trips, I would see the Florida landscape, and it kind of, I think, imprinted on me that primordial sense of Florida. And that, coupled with a friend who was involved in the slow food movement, got me very interested in our connection to food and our disappearing connection to the food chain. So those two things, along with these first encounters with cracker culture, made me realize that there really was a culture here and that it was not just, you know, I think people tend to lump in ideas about rural culture and lump in ideas about what is redneck, what is white trash, what is cracker. And there's a lot of confusion, a lot of blurring of lines, and I think it contributes to a lot of conflict and tension politically and socially and otherwise in our country, even outside of Florida. The red state, blue state thing, I think rural-urban dilemmas, working class, non-working class. So I think that you know, the act of trying to understand and trying to tease out the nuances and trying to really understand and give voice and give dignity to these real cultures that have a meaningful connection to the land, which cracker culture does, and can, I think, teach us a lot in exploring it and learning how to survive in the Florida wilderness. I mean, we're losing that skill, and I think that it's something that still exists in cracker culture, which is disappearing quickly, and it's a shame that it is.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with now California-based artist Julie Lara Khan, but someone who's a native Miamian who has lived in Miami much of her life and even spent a couple of years on Merritt Island researching a project on cracker culture in Florida. You know, I guess what you're saying is true generally, and you said that, is true across the country, that regionalism is disappearing, and, you know, there used to be pockets, you know, in Appalachia, and, you know, it was different in Tennessee and Texas and, you know, and Montana, you know, the people who lived there were distinctly different, and I think with TV and the interstate highway system and travel and education and the internet, all of those differences are being just blurred and merged and disappeared, you know, so you're trying to document, I guess, something that is disappearing in Florida and that was a way of life for many, many people for many, many decades and, you know, for more than a century, I suppose. But let's talk for a minute about cracker food, because as I said at the outset, a lot of people in Florida would be surprised to find out the kind of things that people ate back then when they were living off the land. As you said, people no longer know how to live off the land. You lived in a derelict orange grove. I suspect you might have eaten an orange or two off of the trees. And I once lived right after college in a pecan orchard where I was on the edge of a lake, and I took a canoe out, and there were many nights when I was 21, 22, 23 in there that I had to catch a bass and boil up some grits and collect some pecans in order to have something resembling dinner, believe
that
it or
sounds
not.
Great.
Well, you know, things like that tend to sound great at a distance, but they're basically tough when you're there, right? So that's
definitely
the trick with those things. You can romanticize them, but if you're living them, it's not too romantic sometimes. But you mentioned that cracker food obviously, you know, included, like I just said, seafood and freshwater fish of all kinds and shellfish and things. But apart from that, the meat would be, you said, rattlesnakes and alligators and wild hogs earlier. What are some more?
Yeah, and I think even those came a little bit later, and some of those were more tourist cultivation. You know, the idea of eating gator, I think, came along much more as a show and roadside attraction than really a true cracker food. But and of course, Marjorie Kinnan Rollins' book Cross Creek really sheds light on a lot of Cross Creek cookery. It has so many of the recipes and wonderful ideas about food that crackers ate. But you know, everything from squirrel and possum and even maybe armadillo and soft-shell turtle and cooter and
cooter is what, a snapping turtle?
I think cooter is considered a soft-shell turtle. I've heard debates about it, but I think it's considered soft-shell turtle. But,
okay, I once knew the term, but I've forgotten. But they did eat snapping turtles also, I think, right?
I think so, yeah. And mullet and all kinds of fish, of course. And
and some things a little higher on the food chain, like raccoons.
Uh-huh, raccoons, yeah. I never heard of someone cooking a raccoon, but I'm sure it happened.
Oh, yeah, they did. They went on coon hunts, and it wasn't just for the sheer sport.
Nor for the skin, yeah.
They weren't aristocratic Britishers chasing a fox. They were looking for food. But, yeah, you said frog legs for sure. And other things higher in the food chain. Some of these things get to be shocking in our terms today. Bear, for example, right?
Sure.
And one that's even more shocking. The original term that I grew up with, knowing what a manatee was sea cow. And they weren't called sea cow just because they moved slowly and chewed their cud and ate green things, but they were food.
Right.
So they would slaughter them, and it tasted like beef, right? So that was an original source of food along the coast.
And but, I think it was a time when, you know, food was, these animals and this wildlife was plentiful, which, of course, isn't the case today.
Yeah, right. So actually, ironically, deer are becoming more and more plentiful again. We didn't mention deer, and of course, that was a major hunting target at the time. But so those.
And then also, there's the natural, you know, the fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, I was just going to say
swamp cabbage.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. So, what are some of the vegetables that people ate back then?
I think that ultimately, crackers started to cultivate stuff, even though they were pretty nomadic and were, you know, kind of working cows through the swamps. But I think they were growing pole beans and other things in their yards. But then also the things from the wild, so the sable palm tree, which, you know, right now there's a story that's coming out about the sable palm that there's a disease going around and
yes.
we could lose all the sable palm trees in Florida.
Can you imagine? Oh, my gosh. I don't
our
know if you're
tree. Just our state tree, you know.
I don't know if you're old enough to remember in Miami in the early 80s, I guess it was, when the coconut palm blight went through.
I remember that.
And how sad it was to drive along, let's say, the expressways, to have an elevated view of large sections of Miami and to see the naked stalks of these giant Jamaica tall, you know, 100-foot tall palm trees standing there just with nothing on the end, just a stick standing there bent, you know.
I remember. I mean, I think that impacted me greatly as a child.
You know, and that was
heartbreaking.
It was, and that was an awful sight. And you still today, I don't think, can really easily grow Jamaica tall anyway. Coconut palm trees. There are some sort of Malaysian dwarfs and other less stately and elegant sounding trees that you can grow that have coconuts on them. But so what you're referring to is a disease that could potentially wipe out all of the cabbage palms or sable palms, as they're more elegantly known, in Florida. And that would be a disaster.
And I wonder what they do to our state seal. Does that just become a relic? You know, it's on the state seal. It's our state tree, but it's sort of an homage to the fact that we paved Florida.
I know. And what would Florida look like? I mean, the cabbage palm, the sable palm, became kind of the replacement palm for Florida in a way, even though it's less beautiful than a big coconut palm, but it's still a palm tree, right? And so, gosh, without that, Florida would look like some sort of, you know, palmetto desert or parking lot desert, more likely, I suppose, huh?
Right.
Anyway, so, you know, I've heard actually something that a cracker custom was, and I only heard this fairly recently from another guest on the show actually a year or so back, but that they would keep a barrel out on the porch, and in the barrel they would have a very concentrated brine, like just a salt water. And whenever somebody brought something in from the fields or from the hunt, like a, you know, possum or whatever it be, they'd skin it and put it in, if they didn't need it right then, they'd put it in this barrel, which would more or less preserve it in a more or less more or less edible state. And you know, mixing in with the blood, I guess they would clean it, right? But they would put it down there with chunks of meat and everything else in this brine and put a lid on it to keep the bugs out, I guess, as best they could. But whenever anybody came over, you know, the preacher came over on Sunday for Sunday dinner, the wife would reach down in the barrel and fish around and pull up some stuff, some half-rotten pieces of meat,
yep.
and throw that in the stew pot. Stew is a wonderful yep. thing for disguising putrefaction all around the world. curry and peppers and all those things were invented for that purpose. But
I think it's interesting what you say, you know, when you also bring in the wife, you know, would reach in, because that was something also that was interesting to me, was going on a lot of hunts. Typically it was men, although women are also pretty good at hunting, I've found, you know, cracker women. And with one particular family that I'd go hunting with in Christmas, you know, there's the grandmother, matriarch, would, every time I'd call her, I'd say, "Hey, Shirley, what's going on? I'm thinking about coming out today to film some, and what are you doing?" She's like, "Cutting meat." Uh-huh. "I'm cutting meat." Every time I called her, she'd be cutting meat. And that was just, you know, and to see her, and I have a photograph of her where she's just surrounded by just bloody meat that she's, you know, and she's there very poised and, you know, beautiful and kind of bathed in a soft light, and then there's just all of this meat in front of her, and it really, you know, it's a production. The guys go out hunting and they bring back all this stuff, and it's like, what are you going to do with it? So,
well, this was just for her own family? It wasn't for a community or something then, huh?
For her own family, but they have kind of a barn that they've turned into this sort of charity hall almost, and they'll often cook for lots of people or do fundraisers if somebody, you know, I remember during the course of the project, someone had died, and they needed to raise money for a funeral. And so Shirley had a big gathering to raise money for the funeral. So she was were constantly cooking for lots and lots of people. And she was kind enough to cook Actually, she wasn't able to come to Miami, but she prepared all of this food in advance and sent it along with someone to Miami. She prepared this quail in wine sauce that she's famous for, and was really wonderful.
Did they jerk meat and preserve it in that way?
Yeah, they did. In fact, there was I had some of the beef jerky at my show also at the Wild Game Feast, and then people had their Willard Reddit has a famous recipe. He's also from the Christmas area, and he's in his 80s, and he hand wrote the recipe down for me. But it involves, you know, putting meat out on the roof and making sure to keep the flies off of it. And but it was delicious. I mean, we had sort of a side by side tasting with some beef jerkies that are sold on the market today, and the difference was just unbelievable. I mean, the preserve, you really can taste the preservatives and the sugar and the salt that's just kind of,
right,
you know, it just doesn't feel like it's organic to the meat, whereas in the process that he, you know, it takes him time plus the whole process really changes the way the jerky tastes.
It's kind of like the difference if you've ever had milk fresh from the cow, or at least chilled, you know, half an hour from the cow, versus grocery store pasteurized, homogenized milk.
Right.
It's like two different beverages. There's no, right. It's night and day.
And like in Cross Creek Cookery, when Marjorie Kinnan Rollins says you need Dora's milk to make, you know, it's like, okay, well, that's really helpful if I want to recreate your recipe. But the idea, I think, is what you're saying. It's this milk that's fresh from the cow.
Well, you mentioned the wild game tasting, Julie, at your event in Miami, which again was a multi-dimensional.
And multicultural.
Yeah, I guess it was that too, right? But a multimedia. So it was a multi-many things event. And
it was a multi-many things. Yeah, basically it was in two locations that were separated by about a block and a half of sort of blighted Miami downtown blocks. And in one location, people would arrive, and I had a panel discussion with scholars who talked about Florida cracker culture and anthropology and arts and social, they had sort of debates about it. And then there were photographs, there was a sound installation of a cattle drive for the Rooks family. I went on with the Rooks family up in near Inverness. And so as people came into the gallery to go to the panel discussion, they were greeted with the sounds of a cracker basically trying to move his cows through the woods, which is no small task. So he's making the sounds of the cows and telling them to move on ahead, and it's really wonderful. His voice is really incredible.
Wow.
So as people come in the gallery, they're sort of herded into the gallery with the sound of this cattle drive, and then the panel discussion happened in the room, which contained about 22 very large color photographs, which I took with a large format 4x5 camera. And then they would move more into the space, into a room that was showing video vignettes, about 18 different vignettes for about 20 minutes of just sort of insight into Florida cracker life. There's a guy cracking a whip and talking about crackers. There's a cowboy talking about how the traditions are fading. There's someone on a boar hunt. There's kids playing in the mud. I mean, it's really all different feelings about what cracker life is. And it's also meant to ask some questions, you know, about what is a Florida cracker, and to use some of the confusion that I think exists to encourage the viewer to ask their own questions and come to their own conclusions and do a little bit more research. So, and I think it does that. And then when they were leaving the sort of gallery space, they were asked to take a button, and the button had a silhouette of the state of Florida in orange, and written over it were words like native or alien or redneck or resident or white trash or cracker. And they kind of had to select one, and that would get them entry into the wild game tasting. So after they took their button, they'd walk through some very, very urban streets of Miami, hopefully with these images of cracker culture in their heads, and kind of take this meditative walk to the wild game tasting. And there I had black and white photographs projected on the walls that were from my years researching them with black and white photography. And there were about, I would say, 12 families that came to cook different things that they had harvested themselves from the wild.
Well, they cooked right there on site, huh?
What's that?
They cooked right there on site, huh?
They cooked right there on site. They brought, you know, Beau Rooks trailed his cooker, you know, 7 hours down the interstate, and his smoker, and people made quail and wine sauce. Shirley made her quail and wine sauce. There was, of course, swamp cabbage. There was fried gator, frog's legs. The Yearling restaurant contributed a sour orange pie. I had just all kinds of things. It was really quite a feast. Oh, there was soft shell turtle chili. I mean, just really, really, really amazing things. And then I also put up a display of emails that I had received from crackers around the state over the course of the project, and just sharing recipes with me, inviting me to their families' gatherings, and really wanting to share their culture with me. They had read an article that was written about the project earlier.
This was quite a production. What was the reception in Miami? What was the?
Yeah, it was really, really great. We had just a packed house, standing room only during the scholar discussion, and you know, it was full, and the beautiful thing is that it was full of people who, the diversity that makes up Miami, which is, you know, a lot of first-generation immigrants, a lot of people from many, many different backgrounds, plus some crackers who happen to live in Miami, plus some Miamians, and the diversity was great, and I think people, it forced them to look at Florida in a different way, to look at the land in a different way, and to realize that just 3 hours to the north, there are people that have been living on the land for generations that do have a connection to the land. And I felt like people also made connections to their own home cultures. Like, I talked to many Cubans who said, you know, we have a tradition like this. We have some food traditions that are similar of, you know, of roasting whole hogs also,
sure.
Or we have a tradition of people that have lived on the land in Cuba. And just talking about cooking and breaking bread with people and getting people in a room to really talk about their traditions and learn about Florida traditions.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with artist Julie Lara Khan about her exhibition called Swamp Cabbage, which took place in Miami a while back, that kind of just explored all of the elements of cracker culture, crackers being the nomadic, well, they weren't totally nomadic, but really the rural people who lived in Central and North Florida from the early 1800s on into the, I guess, now. But that leads me to my next question, Julie. This is really a disappearing phenomenon and a disappearing culture. How much of it really exists in its sort of, quote, real form now from your explorations?
I feel like there are some families that really work hard to hold on to the traditions and actually, you know, live out some aspects of cracker culture. It's a lot harder because I think to live as a true cracker means being able to live independent of the law and being able to live freely on the land. And we have so many, you know, everything's fenced, everything's paved, and the land that you can just go disappear and hunt in, those lands are, you know, state lands, you need permits. It's really difficult maintain these traditions and to live a true cracker life.
Well, there's zoning restrictions and ordinances, and you're hemmed in by laws as well as the physical boundaries, right?
Exactly, and also as well as wildlife stock boundary, because it's, you know, you can't take a sable palm tree legally anymore, definitely not off state lands, and so it has to be privately owned, and there really now has to be a very close connection between conservation and practicing some of these ways of life. And it didn't used to be that way. It was like, it used to be, you didn't have to hunt a cabbage palm, that's for sure. You just go out and cut one down. And it's just not that way anymore.
When I was in high school in Fort Pierce in the mid-60s, I was both a swamper and a surfer, right? Which meant that I had a foot in both, in two different, really different cultures. We lived on the beach, but I like, you know, I like to roam around in the woods, and I liked hunting, some aspects of hunting, and I was a pretty avid hunter for a couple of years there, I have to say, 15, 16, 17. And so on the swamper side, I had some friends who were in high school with me and, you know, were civilized kids, but their parents were like you're describing, really. You know, I remember one guy in particular who's a father who made his living trapping and shooting alligators, which was illegal at the time. They were protected. Mm-hmm. He would skin alligators, so he was basically a poacher, and he was almost like today would be an illegal drug dealer, you know, and he lived in the underground market of dealing with alligator hides, and he was an interesting character. He was kind of a gentleman, you know. He wasn't like some rough, you know, guy you were worried would shoot you at a drop of a hat or whatever. He was an interesting fellow, but he lived a wild life apart from the law, like you're describing. But I imagine most such people now have day jobs, and they just kind of keep elements of that life and that culture alive. Would you say that's true?
I think for the most part, although I did find, you know, I would say that the cowboys are still the ones closest to the land and closest to living somewhat of a cracker life, because at least they're out there with the cows in the swamp, mending fences, working with the land. And to me, you know, they are able to integrate their day jobs with a cracker lifestyle. Although, you know, I think that that is changing as people are using four-wheelers and jeeps to round up cattle more, which has a lot of problems associated with it and can do a lot of damage to the cows. You know, the cowboy culture is disappearing as they're being replaced by machinery, as everywhere else. But, you know, I think that as people discover the damage that it does to the cows, and that perhaps, you know, before the cowboy legacy is totally gone from Florida, they'll be able to renew some of it.
Well, even the ranches they work on as cowboys are disappearing to a great extent under pressure of development with, you know, the recent boom we had, and the difficulty of ranching, and the difficulty of, you know, agricultural pursuits in general with the cost of energy and everything else. It's a tough row to hoe. When a hurricane comes through and ruins your crop, there you go for the year, you know.
Definitely.
It's not like you lose a day's work, you lose a year's work. But we just have a minute or so left, Julie. Where does the word cracker come from? I don't think we said that yet.
That's a nice trick question to end on.
Okay.
It's really in debate, and there are a lot of different possible origins, everything from the crack of the cattle whip to the Scotch-Irish term for crake, which would be, you know, kind of being a braggart or cracking on someone.
Cracking, like cracking a joke, kind of? Almost like
yeah, that. Cracking a joke or just even cracking on someone, you
okay.
know, kind of like... to cracking corn, which is more, I think, of the Georgia, people sort of think it's more of the Georgia term, too.
Okay.
Some people say the Spanish called them Quakers.
Huh. I'll be darned. So what do you think it came from?
I think more the crack of the cattle whip.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And I think a more salient question is, am I a cracker? I was born, I'm second-generation Floridian, and are you a cracker if you were born in Florida?
I'm a third-generation Miamian, but I think that makes me a third-generation Miamian. I don't think
it makes me
a cracker.
Not a cracker. My favorite definition of if you're a cracker is whether or not you can skin a gator, and if you can catch a wild boar in a 40-acre field, then you're a cracker.
Well, that narrows it way down. So, Julie Lara Khan, thanks for being with us. You've moved to California now, but I hope we don't lose you with your fascination with Florida's past and its connection to Florida's today, right? So I hope you still
definitely keep those. Definitely not. I've got a new project, a documentary film called Swamp Cabbage I'm working on with a friend. Look
Good.
For it.
Good. Well, we'll keep up with you. Thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next Sunday, same time, same place for more American Variety Radio.